Okay. When last we spoke, we were about to conclude the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, and we're currently on in chapter 50, verse 15. Now, here is a problematic and interesting verse. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong we did him?" It's the first time, since now they are aware that Joseph is Joseph, that we hear the anxiety that must have existed all along, and recalls, by the way, among other things, when Jacob and Esau had their falling out. Remember what Esau says? When dad dies, I'm going to kill you, right? And we know that this is not a strange thing for family dynamics, which is as long as the parent is alive, then the kids will restrain their contempt or anger at one another. But as soon as the parent is gone, that's it. It's over. So the brothers now are worried that Joseph's one behavioral restraint. He has no restraint of power because he's the second most powerful man in Egypt, but he had obviously, and his mother is gone. His only restraint was his father. You know, this is Philip Roth said this. Philip Roth said, every Jewish boy is 17 and stays 17 until his father dies. So there is that, there's something, yes. And now think of all the Jewish boys you know, now you understand. See, you didn't know, now you know. Yeah. There you go. Now, all I can say is those of you who are thinking of that, there, you know, in Hebrew, there's something called the Resha. Actually, it's Aramaic. The Resha and the Seifa. In the Talmud, we always talk about it. The Resha is the beginning of the sentence, and the Seifa is the end of the sentence, right? So all of you who are thinking, you know, immature Jewish men, you're only responding to the Resha. The fact that they will mature when their father died is the Seifa, and you don't know that yet. Right? So if they're immature, that doesn't necessarily mean that their father's death will precipitate this leap of maturity. But you can always hope. You can hope. Yes, exactly. Anyway, so Joseph's father is dead, and the restraint on his behavior towards his brothers is now gone. And the brothers are afraid that that means that he's going to take some kind of revenge on them, because now there's no reason not to. It also tells you, in a sad sort of way, that their opinion of Joseph has not actually gotten that much better since he was a kid. Because if they change their view of who Joseph was, they wouldn't think that this is the kind of person who's going to take revenge on them. Remember, when he was young, they thought he's a dreamer, he's a narcissist. I mean, they didn't use these words, obviously. He's a dreamer, he's a narcissist. In fact, the rabbis say that. The rabbis say when Joseph was young, he couldn't pass a mirror without looking at himself, right? Which is obviously it's an anachronism. They didn't have mirrors all over the ancient world. But the idea was that Joseph was vain, he was self-involved, and all of this. But we've seen a character arc. We've seen Joseph change. But the brothers don't seem, either they don't see that, or it's overridden by their own fear. Because a lot of times, obviously, the way we see other people has much more to do with what's going on inside of us than it has to do with them. And the brothers are afraid. So they sent this message to Joseph. Before his death, your father left this instruction. So shall you say to Joseph, forgive, I urge you, the offense and guilt of your brothers who treated you so harshly. Therefore, please forgive the offense of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him. Now, there's a lot to unpack here. Let's start with the fact that they sent this message to Joseph. It doesn't say they spoke this message to Joseph, which already suggests that Joseph erects some kind of barrier between the brothers and himself, even though in a parallel, for those of you who remember last week, in a parallel between Joseph and Jacob, between Joseph and Pharaoh, at the end it says Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him. So it could be the same thing that happened with Joseph and Pharaoh, where it makes that same switch. which is Joseph sitting on his throne. There are a series of interpreters or whatever. You say it to the interpreters, but Joseph overhears, in quotes, what they're saying. So they spoke to him, but they didn't speak to him directly because he's the viceroy of Egypt, and you just don't march in there and talk to the viceroy of Egypt like that. You just don't. Instead, there's this barrier, which, if true, if that, first of all, if that's true, so you understand why the brothers are afraid of him, because Joseph is maintaining the distinction between himself and his siblings because he's the, you know, he's the one that made it, basically. I saw the, I don't know how many of you, this is sort of random, but the Fareed Zakaria has this show on Sunday morning, and he interviewed the president of Singapore. And the president of Singapore is the child of the president of Singapore. And he said, none of my siblings chose to go into this line of work. Right? He was a very engaging, interesting guy, by the way, very interesting. Anyway, he said, none of my siblings chose to go into this line of work. And I immediately thought to myself, I wonder how he relates to his brothers. Sisters too, but especially brothers, right? Because father was, he is. Is there any, like when a sibling becomes a president, is there any, does it change at all the nature of the dynamics of the sibling relation? I have no idea, right? But I thought here, like, does Joseph present it? Also, obviously there are other factors, what they did to Joseph and the fact that they've been away for so long, but it doesn't seem like there's any kind of equality here. It seems like Joseph is still on his throne. Remember, Joseph steps off his throne to say to them, I am Joseph, your brother. Which means that when you, the word condescend, it has descend in it, right? He had to go down to say to them, I am Joseph, your brother, but it doesn't say they didn't go back up on his throne afterwards, and he apparently did. So the first thing is they feel inferior, and Joseph seems to be maintaining this barrier, although we don't know that for a fact. And then he says, before his death, your father left this instruction. And we have no idea, and the commentators are divided about this, whether it's true or not. We have no idea. I mean, you can imagine, first of all, let's assume that it's not true. You can imagine why the brothers would say this to Joseph, because once the father dies and the only restraint is gone, the best they have is a dying man's wish. And if they can persuade Joseph that it's true, then, right, then okay. And in some ways, what you get here is there's an interesting switch. There's a parallel between the life of Moses that we're about to start and the life of Joseph, right? Moses grows up in the palace and goes out to the people. Joseph grows up with the people and ends up in the palace, right? Moses doesn't seem to have any sort of parental influence on him at all, right? His father's mentioned, but has no, Moses is sort of a self-created person. Joseph is very much the product of his father, but both of them have sibling tensions. Both of them do. Remember, Miriam and Aaron gossip about Moses. Joseph's brother throw him into the pit. There's something about the, I mean, there are sibling tensions in every family, but also partly if a family throws up somebody who is clearly different from the rest of the family, that creates a sort of double tension. I think this sometimes, for example, about athletes in families, star athletes. You know, it must be very hard to grow up, because especially in most countries, they start very young, to grow up and know that your brother, sister, whatever is going to be is going to be a big star and make a huge amount of money and get all this adulation, and you're their sibling. I was thinking about this because I can't remember her name. The best college basketball player, women's basketball player in the country, apparently by far, she has a sister who is blind, deaf, and has cerebral palsy. And she was recruited by some, I heard this story on National Public Radio, she was recruited by some big college, yeah, you can look it up on your iPad, right? That's cheating. And she went away to play, but after a year, she couldn't do it. She couldn't leave her sister alone because her sister knows her by touch and by smell. So she went back home and she was playing for some small college because Delaware, right? It was Delaware. For one year she didn't play, and then she, what's her name?
I did not look it up. I remember the story.
Right. No, I believe it. I believe. Right. Exactly. No, I believe you. Yes, I know. Janet wrote me that she downloaded some. She's got the Torah on her iPad. So, which means, by the way, you can never put your iPad on the floor. You know that. I'm just kidding. No. So she went. She went back, and obviously that's a radical and extreme case. But there are these dislocations in families when there's somebody. Remember, I mean, this has happened in all sorts of American. I remember Billy Carter. It's the same thing, right? When you have a brother that's extraordinarily successful and you're not so easy, and here's Joseph who's extraordinarily successful, and here are all his brothers who live with their father, and now they're in Egypt. Remember, they're immigrants, they're in an alien country, they depend on Joseph for their protection. There's a lot of, if you think about it, there's a lot of dynamics going on here, and after all, it's clear that God favors Joseph, right? I mean, just as the last straw also, God is obviously on Joseph's side because God has made Joseph phenomenally successful and has just managed to allow them not to starve. So we don't know if Jacob said this or not, but the second interesting part is it says, please forgive the offense of the servants of God of your father, your brothers who treated you so harshly. We don't know that Jacob actually ever knew about this. We've never heard that before. Jacob has never been told anywhere in the Torah, your sons sold Joseph into slavery. So there are several possibilities here. One is that Jacob actually went to his grave not knowing about it, but they're saying to Joseph subliminally, not only did Jacob say not to protect us, but we told him what we did. That's possible, right? Because Joseph, as far as we know, never told his father what happened. And you can imagine, I mean, there would be motivations for Joseph to say and also not to say. If Joseph is actually as good as we would hope that he is, as opposed to as he might be, then he wouldn't tell his father, because what could it do other than cause his father pain? Right. There's a whole series in Pirkei Avot, there's a whole series of Ezehu Gibor, who's a hero. So I don't know where, probably some old Yiddish joke is, there's a variation on that. Who is a hero? One who suppresses a wisecrack, right? In other words, when you have something funny to say and you don't say it, that's heroic. But also, when you suppress a legitimate complaint, that makes you a hero. Right? It's very hard if you have especially a big legitimate complaint, not to say it. And you can imagine that Joseph must have had a very powerful motivation to tell Jacob. But if he doesn't tell Jacob, that's pretty heroic of him to protect his brothers that way. So if, in fact, Jacob did say this to the brothers, one possibility of the many variations is that, or if he didn't say it, rather, and they're making it up, one possibility is that they're telling Joseph, we told that about it. Whether they did or not, we don't know. If Jacob did say this to the brothers, okay, let's say they're not making it up. Let's say they're really reporting what Jacob said. That argues for Jacob's low opinion of Joseph. Remember that Jacob is afraid, if he really said this, that Joseph is going to treat the brothers harshly. So he told them, make sure you say to Joseph, I forbid you from the grave from taking punishment on your brothers. And this is the same Jacob, remember, who made Joseph swear that he would bring the body back to Canaan. As you recall, the scene was Joseph said, I will bring your body back, and Jacob says, swear it. And we said maybe he was doing that so that Joseph would have a better argument in front of Pharaoh. My dad made me swear, I can't help it, I have to do it. But maybe Jacob didn't trust him. We don't know. And if Jacob, it depends what thread you want to follow, if Jacob didn't trust Joseph, and you want to reinforce that idea that he didn't trust him, here's piece of evidence number two, which is he told the brothers, tell Joseph. Although why he didn't tell Joseph directly is, and that's one of the arguments that the commentators who don't believe Jacob really said this, they say if Jacob wanted to say to Joseph, don't mistreat the brothers, he would have told Joseph, don't mistreat the brothers. It's much more effective than telling the brothers to tell him that I said. I mean, they had enough. We know they had time together, so it seems unlikely. And then the next question is Joseph's tears. As I said, Rabbi Sacks, who actually just visited, Jonathan Sacks, has this short piece where he talks about how often Joseph cries. Joseph cries all through this story. And by the way, it's not, you can imagine that somebody who is so sensitive to dreams and to other people's emotional states probably has a very sensitive emotional register. His crying all the time actually is consistent with everything else that we know about Joseph, right? He has an artistic temperament. That's how he gets to, he doesn't get to be a ruler through, you know, bureaucratic infighting. He gets to be a ruler through understanding people's dreams. So it's not strange that he would. But the question is, what are Joseph's tears about? Are they about that his father didn't trust him to say? Are they about the fact that he's now discovering that his father knew that his brother sold him into slavery? Or are they about the fact that his brothers don't believe that he would be kind to them? And he can't believe after all they've been through that they still don't trust the goodness of his intentions, since he set them up in Goshen and he's made sure they had a living and on and on and on. And they all went back home to bury their father together, and they come back and the first thing he hears from them is, we don't trust you to take care of us, basically. Because whether Jacob said it or not, the brothers reporting it clearly indicates an unease about whether he'll be nice to them, right? Otherwise they wouldn't have said it. All those things are possible. But it's painful and poignant in a way that to the very end of the book, it's clear that this sibling relationship is irrevocably broken in some way, and they can't quite. And look at Joseph's response. His brothers went to him themselves, flung themselves before him and said, we are prepared to be your slaves. Now, again, what's the motivation? I mean, there's a certain abasement out of fear, but also it may also be a pro forma way of beginning an apology. We don't know if it's like literal. The way it sounds in English is horrendous. I mean, but in the ancient world, there was a lot of formulaic stuff that was not necessarily, and if you want to know how little we understand the customs of other ages, all you have to do is read the LA Times this morning, where there was this, or no, it was the New York Times. But Neil Genslinger, who's the TV critic, there's apparently a TV show that's coming on jousting. So he literally got up in the get. They're actually jousting. It's a very funny article too. He gets up in this jousting getup and he goes out to joust. And one of the things that he talks about the athleticism of it and the difficulty of it and what exactly you have to do and why the armor was the way it was. And I thought, I've watched, you know, like you, 1,000 movies where people joust, but I have no idea what actually was involved. And the same thing is true here. It may be that this is how you begin, right? How you supplicate someone is you throw yourself on the ground and say, we will be your slaves. It doesn't necessarily have to be taken literally, although it's also a presaging of what exactly is going to happen to Israel beginning in the next book, right? Which is all of Israel is going to be the slaves of the throne of Egypt, not of Joseph, but of the throne of Egypt. And the explanation you'll see for their going into slavery is there arose a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Joseph was the one bulwark between Israel and slavery. So, but Joseph said to them, have no fear. Am I a substitute for God? I love this speech. Besides, although you intended me harm, just want to note, you did mean to destroy me and to kill me, but I'm all right, it's okay, don't worry. Although you intended me harm, this is the first occasion where there's a Yiddish accent in the Torah. I don't know if you're aware of this. It's all right, I'm okay. I'll sit in the dark. Besides, although you intended me harm, God intended it for good, so as to bring about the present result, the survival of many people. So fear not, I will sustain you and your children. Thus he reassured them. It says, speaking kindly to them is not exactly, Vayinachem otam is reassured them. Vayadaber al libam, he spoke to their hearts. It's not the same as speaking kindly, he spoke to their hearts, which could mean just that he knew what to say that would touch them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he said something that was kind, because you can hear in the speech that he's it's a mixed talk, right? It's some part of it is very nice, but some part of it is very reminiscent of, look, this is what you did to me, and we all, it's all out in the open now, we're all, you know, we're all adults, and we all know what you meant, but don't worry, I don't hold it against you, because God intended it differently from the way you intended it. So, you know, it's the whole, one of the interesting things about this is you can read this exchange in so many different ways, depending on how you want to slice it. But however you do, it's not the kind of ending where the music swells and the credits roll and everything is fine. It's not. There's a little bit of unease. It's almost like the ending of The Graduate. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Graduate. And at the very end, he runs to the church, where it seems, by the way, that they've already been married. But he runs to the church, and she runs away with him, and they get together on a bus. And then the last shot is you see their faces, and they think you can see in their faces they're thinking, oh my God, what did we just do? It's not like they're going to be happy ever after. There's ambiguity in the closing shot. And the same thing is true here. It's not, I mean, yeah, Joseph will take care of them, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be best friends. So Joseph and his father's household remained in Egypt. Joseph lived 110 years. Remember I told you that the rabbis say why he lost those 10 years, right? Because five times he heard them refer to his father without acknowledging it. And it was really 10 times because then the Egyptian translator translated what they said. So for each time that happened, the rabbis say God took 1 year off his life. Joseph lived to see the children of the third generation of Ephraim. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were likewise born upon Joseph's knees. At length, Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die. God will surely take notice of you and bring you up from the land to the land that he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. So Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, when God has taken notice of you, you shall carry up my bones from here. Joseph died at the age of 110 years. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Now, I talked about the coffin of Joseph last time. I'm not going to talk about it again, but I want to talk about two things before we take questions. The first is the passage and then what's written at the very bottom if you have the JPS translation. The idea that he is planting the future and that he knows the future because he says, I ensured the survival of many people and God will bring you up from here, it's the sequel, basically. It's planting the sequel. That is, this story is not over. It's going to continue, and it's clear that Joseph is going to play a role in that, and in fact he does. And it's seeding what will happen in the future, but we don't know how all of those things. Remember, when you read the Torah, part of the Torah assumes that you know all of it, but part of it assumes that you're reading it for the first time. So you have no idea how all of this is going to play out, but it will. And also you can see that there's a certain amount of trust between Joseph and the brothers, because he says to them, you know, I'm trusting you that you will pass on this idea that I'm supposed to be returned to Canaan when Israel is liberated from here. And then at the very bottom you see it says Tam v'nishlam tehillah le'el borei olam, it's sometimes Tam v'nishlam shevach le'el borei olam, which means completed and finished, or finished and perfect sometime. Praised be the creator of the world. In traditional Hebrew books, and I actually got this in one of my books, I got the publisher to put it at the end of one of my books. In traditional Hebrew books, that's what you're supposed to say at the end of the book. It's a way of thanking God. Tam v'nishlam is completed and finished, or perfect and finished, depending on which. Shevach is praise, le'el borei olam, to God who created the world. The idea being that any work of human beings is also is due to God's goodness or blessing or whatever, and so you don't just finish a book, you finish a book by thanking God. And also in the service, when you finish the book, you say chazak, chazak, v'nit chazek, which means strong, strong, and may we be strengthened. The idea being, may you be given the strength to go on and read the next, you know. Or in fact, when you finish a tractate of Talmud, you say hadran alach. And there's an argument among scholars about what Hadran Alach means. It's a long passage, but it starts off Hadran Alach, which either means glory on you, that is on the tractate, or I will return to you. The idea being that you would always want to come back to whatever it was that you were studying. And let me just close by telling you one really wonderful story. And I don't remember, I heard it from my father, and I don't remember what rabbi, it was a friend of his, I remember, but I don't remember what rabbi this happened to. But he bought at a used book sale, which is, which used to be quite common in the world. He bought a set of Shas, a set of the Talmud, and he stored it in his garage. And one day there was a rainstorm and it was a leak, and he went in to rescue it, and he saw that several of them were damaged by water, and he was flipping through them, and he flipped through one and he saw some writing. And what it said was, my name is so-and-so. I live in, I don't remember, it was Warsaw, somewhere in Eastern Europe, and this is such and such a date. I have studied up to this point. They're coming to get me and my family. Whoever finds this, please start studying here from me. Yeah, incredibly. But the beautiful part of that horrible story is that that's what mattered to him, was that somebody should continue studying from where he left off. So, okay. Questions? Yeah.
First of all, Joseph was the tzaddik among his brothers, and he
yes.
was almost the youngest besides Benjamin. Right. How come he lived less than those, because they were alive when he was dying?
Why was Joseph was the tzaddik among his brothers, and he lived? It's a good question, and he was one of the youngest. Why is it that his brothers are still alive? We don't know which brothers. I mean, it could have been one or two brothers when he said to his brothers. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
When you want, many times when you want to say I, you say bande, which means enslaved. So when
really?
I talk to you, I say, I want to ask you something, I would say, I, the slave, ask you to come with me.
Interesting.
So
that self-abasement, where you refer to yourself as a slave, is not right. And the I am your servant, you know, that idea is not right.
Yeah, but yeah. The slave is exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That they sent a message to Joseph about Jacob's message, and then at the end it says Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him.
Right.
Is this two different days?
No, that's why I said it's a parallel with the Pharaoh and Jacob thing, where you have the exact same switch or pair of with Joseph rather and Pharaoh, where you have the exact same switch. So there was probably a line of interpreters in the middle. So they said it not to Joseph, but to the interpreters in theory, but he heard them and answered them directly. That would be my guess, yeah. Yeah, you would think so. I mean, the commentators who don't believe the story, one of the points that they make, and they make several, one of the points that they make is there's no reason to think that Jacob wouldn't have said this to Joseph directly. The counter to that is maybe he did, but he also said to the brothers, listen, remind Joseph that you should, and that the two aren't necessarily incompatible. Part of it has to do also with, you know, how much Jacob believed he could control Joseph's behavior after he died. I don't know. Remember what Jacob says to the brothers when they're going off to Egypt? Don't fight among yourselves on the journey, right? He doesn't have a lot of faith in the fraternal feelings of the brothers in general. So it's not impossible that he said it to Joseph, and then he said to the brothers, tell Joseph that I said, which will recall to Joseph the conversation that they had. That's also conceivable. But what is so interesting is, you know the author, whoever is the author of the Torah, God, human being, some combination, whoever wrote this story has to know that the reader will wonder, is this true or not? It's left deliberately ambiguous, right? If you wrote this story down, the first thing that would occur to you is, well, they're going to wonder if he really said it or not. So in some ways, the most interesting part of this is the fact that the Torah doesn't tell us if it's true. What's the lesson there of not being told, of wondering? And maybe, here's one stab at it, if you were going to give a sermon on this Shabbos, is that the source of the message is far less important than the content of the message, which is whether Jacob said this or not, this is what's right. And it doesn't matter that Jacob said it, and it doesn't matter if you doubt that Jacob said it, it's still what you should do. So, yeah.
Has anyone ever done a study on whether Jacob knew what the brothers did to Joseph?
Because yes. It's much discussed, but no certain conclusion.
But no conclusion.
No.
Okay, and then how about the, I like this paragraph in here about the brothers saw Joseph make a side trip to the pit in which he'd been thrown as a child to reflect.
Right.
That hasn't been proven.
It's a midrash. It's not in the Torah. It's a midrash that right, they took a side trip to the pit just, you know, for old time's sake. Where Joseph was thrown. And you can imagine it's a natural midrash since they went back presumably by the same route. It's a natural midrash to assume that Joseph would want to revisit that place. And you know, there are blessings, I don't know if you're aware of this, there are blessings in the Talmud, there are blessings in Hebrew, in Jewish tradition. When you come to a place where you had some kind of miraculous deliverance, that you say, God made a miracle for me in this place. There are people, for example, who survive terrible accidents that go back to the site and say that blessing, things like that. So maybe Joseph went there to say that blessing. Yeah.
The way I read it, and from what we know from the brothers, to me it's clear that they make this up.
Yeah. Why?
Because it says that they thought, oh, what if he still has a grudge against
right.
us? And they just made it up.
Right. Yeah, the fact that it says beforehand, why did they were afraid that he had a grudge against us, is certainly evidence for the they made it up theory, because there was no reason to say that unless it was to suggest that it wasn't true. But it's interesting that the Torah doesn't say, and they invented this story, which it could have, yeah.
I have a kinder explanation. The brother
a kinder, gentler explanation?
Gentler. Yeah. The brother is at Joseph's deathbed, admitted their sins to him to clear their consciences, and were forgiven by Joseph, who then said, in recompense, tell Joseph that you are free of sin.
Right.
And this made Joseph cry.
That is possible. That's possible. They confessed on the deathbed, and that's what made him cry. It's a nice, I like that explanation. Yeah. Yes, we're all doing it, so why not jump in?
I think it's incredibly important for parents that their kids get along. And I think if you told those guys, I've never been in a situation, but I'm guessing that's a common wish, whether articulated or not,
right.
of a lot of dying parents that got me. When I'm leaving, I just hope that my
yep.
kids stay together and get along.
Yes.
So to me, it is likely that he might at least be thinking that, whether or not he's...
Right. It's certainly, I mean, I hear this all the time when I talk to families before funerals. Is that one thing that was important to our parent is that we get along. Ironically, you know, at times of funerals, like times of weddings, is when families are most tested. And families, even families that get along, don't always get along then because it's just so high tension. But it is frequently said that that is the wish of the, you know, the two most common wishes are take care of my surviving spouse and you know, don't fight among yourselves. So yeah, it's certainly, I have no doubt that Jacob wished this, whether he said it in this way is, yeah. Okay, let's start on this side. Yes, in the back, 1 second. Adam. Yeah, go ahead. Well, presumably it's expressed before the funeral. I'm just saying when I talk to the family at the funeral, they say one thing that Dad always cared about was that we... Well, everybody does. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. You know, sometimes parents who get along with their siblings say, I want that for you too. And sometimes, right. Yes. Look, the contradiction, right, the contradiction of the way parents act and the way they want their children to act is woven, it's not only parents and children, it's woven through all human beings, right? All human beings can give better advice to others than sometimes they live themselves. That's, if they couldn't, nobody would be in the advice business. We'd all have to get out of the advice business because it's, you know, there's, I mean, it goes back to Shakespeare when he says, physician, heal thyself. It's just, that's the same thing is true of parents and clergy and doctors and psychiatrists and everybody whose business it is to tell other people how to live. You know, that doesn't mean that they know how to live. It just means they know how other people should live. Yeah. Well, there's a book by James Kugel called In Potiphar's House, where he talks about all sorts of alternatives that exist in the Joseph story. I don't remember if there's an alternative here in the Book of Jubilees and elsewhere and in the Midrash. There's a lot of expansion and difference and so on, and you would expect that since it's the longest story in the Torah, the longest single story in the Torah. I don't remember if there's an alternative to this in particular. I'll have to take a look. I mean, that is an interesting question about whether, since he doesn't absolve them for Shechem, based on the blessing where he talks about the violence of Shimon and Levi, would he be inclined to absolve them for having deprived him of Joseph for most of his life? And for cruelty and for so on, right, and for trying to kill Joseph. The only thing I would say is that the motivation for his absolution of the brothers would be what will happen between them after he dies. So maybe he thinks, I don't really want to absolve them, but if I don't absolve them, I'm creating more conflict after I'm gone. So maybe, but it's true that it would be inconsistent with the way he treats the Shechem incident. So, Don? Yes.
And bringing together, I think there may be a period of, you know, which is, it may be tough to ask for forgiveness, it may be tough to admit the guilt, but the guilt is admitted here, and forgiveness is given, and forgiveness is given, but all of life and religion, and what they do will lead to somewhere. And in the end,
yes. Right. That is a nice. It's a nice image that the bones are buried. So maybe that's the. Yeah.
What puzzles me is Jacob's a tough character to follow. It seems to me. Here we're talking about the forgiveness of the brothers to Joseph. That whole death scene. When we hear of Jacob's death, we don't seem to hear that his life flashed before him, and that perhaps he owed Esau some kind of money.
Nope. Esau's reconciled. That's done. That's
it's
done.
It's not mentioned. It's, and yet that's who we are, who we became. And it's silent. It's puzzling.
Why is it puzzling? He's reconciled to Esau, and now he's dying.
No, but did he ask Esau for forgiveness? I don't recall.
Well, they were on they wept on each other's necks, and he gave him gifts and so on. So, So I think that there's clear reconciliation. But I mean, also, you know, look at the What both of you just said actually makes a nice contrast, what Don just said and you said. In some ways, there's a nice closure, but in the Torah, there's always more left out than is told, always, in every single story. It's a very bare-bones telling.
They leave it to us.
So, yes. But it doesn't seem like Esau is a factor anymore. It just doesn't.
I just wonder whether that answer wouldn't flash before his eyes.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what flashes, what doesn't flash.
Well, they say yeah, your life right.
No.
Or any communication
other than. No, that's it. We're done. We're done. Yeah.
Yeah. It says in the beginning of Genesis that God created us in his image and his likeness. And I remember someone said that a lie can travel the entire world before truth can get out of bed. Mm-hmm. And
that was Churchill, before truth gets his pants on.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think it was someone else, but that's good.
It was Churchill, trust me. It's in the Churchill Museum on the wall among his quotes. So,
anyway, these brothers, it's so easy to follow the dynamics of who they are. I mean, they've lied, they've covered up, they've hated, they've resented, they've had bitterness, they've never come clean, there's been no confession at all. And it seems like Joseph, God speaks, and I'm wondering, does God speak to all of us? The problem is there's very little contrition in some of us.
That's a big question. I would say, look, I'm not sure that there's no contrition in the brothers. I think there's a lot of fear, and the usual commentator's take on this is the fact that they're willing to sacrifice themselves to save Benjamin, that Judah comes forward, that Reuven clearly is mortified by what's going to happen to Benjamin is their expression of contrition. Even though they don't say explicitly, Joseph, we are sorry for what we did, this clearly, even the message that they send, we treated you so harshly, at least most of the commentators see that as contrition. And when you say, I would say there's contrition in most of us, and a lot of it is situational. It depends how you accuse, in quotes, someone. You can get an apology from someone if you ask or express hurt that you can't get if you express anger. A lot depends on how the person is approached. You know, everything is relational. It's never just one person and what's inside them. I'm sure there are sociopaths for whom there is no contrition, but most normal human beings have contrition if the other person gives them space for it. That's why you're supposed to ask for forgiveness three times if you offend someone on Yom Kippur. You're supposed to ask three times, because the first time the person's allowed to say, you know what, after what you did, no. But if you keep coming back, that gives them more space. So anyway, Stanley, we have too many. Go ahead. I would say the best reason is that length of life and goodness have no necessary relationship to one another. That's the best reason I can think of. So, yeah.
So it seems to me that, I mean, this is another level. It's much less psychological than a lot of the stuff I've heard. And it's like the whole story seems to me about not only who Joseph is and who all these characters are, but who God is. Mm-hmm. And that the dreams are really... Right. What's important here, and when you talked earlier about the dream of the bowing down, and wasn't this a narcissistic kid? I guess I read it when I was in the Bible comic books when I was 6 or 7,
right.
And to me, this was a dream.
Right.
I had dreams. Joseph had dreams. Seems to me Joseph was an innocent. He wasn't just a narcissistic kid, but he was a kid who these things were happening to him. He didn't know why the hell. He didn't understand that his mother and father were over the other. But he didn't.
They just were the dreams that he woke up with. Right.
So he wakes up and he sees that he has this dream, and he tells them both to the brothers and the fathers, like, what's going on here? Isn't this nice? I like it.
It's a plausible reading.
It comes around here where the whole story is really not about, it is about who people are, and that's what I'm very interested in.
Right.
But it's also how does life work? The dreams came true, and in this scene, the brothers are acknowledging it.
Right.
And I don't, I'm with
You don't think.
Read it straight,
right.
The way I read it, simple. The guys do not.
Right.
Jacob did not set this up. He wasn't so worried about his kids afterwards. He was concerned about his blessing.
Right. The larger framework is right. The larger framework is God is doing it.
Is saying
yeah.
To the, and I don't think Jacob really got. He became Israel, but I don't think he got in his words the overall picture. He enacts it,
right.
But he doesn't explain it. And Joseph here is saying, "Look, guys, I had the dream,
right.
But and you did these
right.
things, and I'm still pissed. But this is all."
Right. The larger picture is certainly that God sets up the whole thing from the beginning, not just from the beginning of the Joseph story. He already tells Abraham that they're going to be slaves in the land of Egypt, and I'm going to liberate them. And then the question is, how will God engineer their going down to Egypt? And now we know how God engineers it, and the artistry of it is that, you know, human beings make choices along the way, and God still gets what God wants. Yeah. Yeah. That's very nice. That's very nice that Joseph doesn't say, as Jacob did, bury me in Israel after I die. He makes the sacrifice of saying, don't bring me up until you all, till everybody leaves, which is a very nice point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talked about that last time. How they two of them were next to each other, and also about the Midrashim of how they found the coffin, but we'll come to that, yeah. What he says is, I'm about to die. God will take notice of you and bring you up from this land that he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, I know you're going to return to Israel. He doesn't say you're going to be slaves, although presumably he knows that because God already told Abraham that they were going to be slaves, which is kind of, it's one of those contradictions that runs throughout the Torah. People seem to know things in advance, but they do it anyway. That is, if God really gave the Torah to Moses at Sinai, why is he surprised about Korach's rebellion? He wrote it, you know, he wrote what was going to happen. He wrote they were going to be swallowed by the earth and so on and so forth. But so there is a sense of sort of gradual unfolding. Yeah.
What's interesting because there was apparently no report of Joseph having a dream about that, but somehow we knew God's intention.
Right, unless he heard it from family tradition, which is, again, one of the frustrating things is we don't know what was said that's not reported. We only know what was reported. And so that's what makes it so difficult. Yeah.
That you did the list. Three explanations about why Joseph cried. Can we add one more?
Sure, you can probably add many more.
To say, sweet revenge, it's the time. And then when they say that we don't do this to us, he says, I have to let go of the revenge and start crying.
I don't like that one very much, I gotta tell you. That Joseph was about to avenge himself on them, but as soon as he got the message, he cried because he couldn't. You know, it's. Let me just say, it's a very cynical. But you can't rule it out of court. You can't rule it out of court. So, are there other? If not, what were you going to say before?
Yeah, I was going to talk before
about contrition. I'll do that. Let's save it for the moment. Anything else about the Torah before we close? Yeah. Yes.
That become very important later on, and it's a careful reading. And I don't, with God taking notice, you know, the Sarah,
mm-hmm.
Sarai, this other woman who notices it and carrying it on in the tradition, it's just such an important.
Well, God's taking note, I mean, the same thing happens in Egypt. Don't forget that God doesn't take notice of them for hundreds of years. Right, the Israelites are slaves in Egypt before God takes notice of them, and it's not clear obviously what it means to say that God takes notice. It's the human way of saying that God takes action. That's basically, I mean, that's as close as we can come. Is God taking? We don't know what internal processes go on with God. All we can say is this happened and that happened. But also, when it says pakod yifkod, when the Hebrew uses a word twice, the traditional explanation is that it's for emphasis. God, it's like saying God noticed. So I remember when I was taking biblical Hebrew with Rabbi Wexler, who's the president of the American Jewish University, he said, When the Hebrew says something twice, biblical scholars and grammarians and so on will say it's for emphasis. And we say something is for emphasis when we don't know why it's there. So the truth is nobody knows why it's repeated twice, and the best we can do is it's for emphasis, but it may have some nuance or some idea that we just don't know. So anyway, okay, and on that note, let's...